Welcome to Esoteric Modulation, episode 010, A Podular Baptism. Esoteric Modulation is your fortnightly podcast that covers all the wild and wonderful world of modular, exciting and unusual instruments, and we take a look into interesting sound and visual art projects too. I'm Ed Ball.
And I'm Ben Wilson. How's it going, Ed?
Yeah, been busy. So are you, though, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm currently in, as if by magic, Seattle while this goes on. Spending time with a guest for the show, hopefully not kind of wandered me out into some woods with a hatchet and either chosen to kill me himself or the bears have got me up. But yeah, I had a great summer of plenty of traveling around for some trips, a Roland launch event, as people will see by this point, being in Barcelona for Modular Day and Seattle. So I'm getting around a little bit.
Yeah, I've been busy too, sort of stoking the fires of art and music. So we have an interesting person on our podcast today. I'm very much looking forward to digging into a conversation with him. He's based out of Seattle, Washington. This man started his modular journey in the warm way, like most of us do, you know, a few modules here and there in search of the perfect system. One thing led to another, and you know the story. Soon you need deep in modular, buying, selling, trading to get that perfect case. But not content of that, he decided to turn up the heat a bit and thought a baptism by fire was needed to get things really moving. He decided to start a podcast up about all things modular. We have all listened to his journey since he stepped into the flames, from a modular fledgling to now a mature narrator of the modular scene that we all so love. He is the host of Podular Modcast, Tim Held. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be on the receiving end of this.
I know, but it's weird, isn't it?
It is kind of weird. I was just telling you before we started recording that I'm more nervous about this than talking to a complete stranger. So it's, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
That's the effect we have, Ed. They get to know us and it's worse.
Yeah, that's it. It's a worrying trait, actually.
Yeah, it goes south.
I would be more nervous had I not. I mean, I've communicated with you, Ed, quite a bit through email and yeah. Facebook. And Ben and I have had lengthy chats on the old Skype. So that definitely eases me. And the funny thing is somebody has told me this before, and it's so weird to hear. But Ed, by listening to your guys' show, I feel like I personally know you. And this is our first real conversation. So it's kind of a weird little dynamic.
It's weird, isn't it, that is, Tim? Because it's, you know, when you watch somebody constantly or you listen to somebody constantly, you sort of feel that you know them and you don't. It's mm-hmm. a weird concept, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got that with a number of podcasts that I've listened to over, you know, probably the past 9 or 10 years that I got into it. You know, I felt like I was friends with Mark Maron for a while, but I've, you know, I actually have met him at a show, but you know, there's this weird feeling of like, I feel like you're my friend and I think that you'd like me. And it's such a weird, it's kind of psychotic.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
It's absolutely psychotic, but it's, but now I'm in it and that's weird. It's very weird.
That'd be a great t-shirt. I think you'd like me. It's just got the right amount of desperation to it.
Yeah, yeah.
To make also, a t-shirt.
It's also pretty confident too, you know, like it's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it's years and years ago listening to, I think it was like the third episode of Leo Laporte's Matt Break Weekly and This Week in Tech, you know, just avid fan of that. And that's like years and years ago. And you feel like you sort of know them. It is a very bizarre concept.
Yeah, and it's got to be a really weird thing for like actually famous people who have people come up to him who have been listening to him for 10 years and can be like, hey, I'm sorry about that time you lost your cat 5 years ago. And it's like, wait, I don't know anything about you. And you know these intimate details about me. So yeah, it's...
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to get to know you more now, Tim. My start was by, you know, telling people you literally did a baptism by fire, didn't you?
Yeah.
You were, I think, fairly early to the modular scene and you just decided to up and do a podcast about that. A absolute ballsy move, mate.
Yeah.
What made you do that and how's it been since then?
One thing, it's kind of twofold. I'm a huge fan of podcasts and anything that I become a fan of, I automatically want to try to do that. So there was always kind of that thing I wanted to do, but I never had a reason. And this is like 20% joke, but my wife literally couldn't listen to me talk about it anymore. And like most people who get grabbed by the bug, all you want to do is talk about it. And I had a handful of friends that I could talk about it with. I just really wanted to learn as much as I could about it. And it seemed like such a warm community, and there was so much stuff going on, and it seemed like it had a real DIY spirit. So I had the idea of wanting to do it, and Mylar ended up releasing his first episode like after I had recorded a bunch of episodes, and I didn't even know his existed. So I made myself kind of a little promise, because I didn't want to start something that fizzled out.
Yeah.
So I'm going to record at least 5 episodes. So trying to find the time to do all that and then get them all edited together. I started in November of 2017, and then I ended up releasing the first episode in March. And I think Mylar ended up releasing in January. And I was just kind of like, I was a little crestfallen because I'm like, well, he's Mylar Melodies and I'm, you know, no one who anybody knows. But what was cool is I could tell by listening to his show and what I had already done that they were going to be A, totally different things. And because I think it's probably because he's so busy and he does it in person, his are once a month. My deal I made myself, which I still don't know why I did this to myself with a full-time job and everything, but was it's got to be weekly because that's something that's important to me as a fan of podcasts. So I just wanted to make sure that I set up some standards for myself. Another reason I went into it is because, you know, I saw that modular is really popular and there wasn't really much in the world of podcasts for it. So I kind of figured, well, that's better than starting a guitar podcast because there's 15,000 guitar podcasts. So I kind of just logically thought, well, I'll have an inherently built-in audience of a few people right off the bat. So that was a part of it. And also I've just spent so much time making records that I don't know how to promote a record. So maybe 35 people, maybe 60 people listen to it, and 35 of them are my friends and they listen to it once because I kind of asked them, you know, 5 times over 4 weeks if they'd listened to it yet. And, you know, it's just like you put all this work into something and you want people to enjoy it. So I thought, well, this is a thirsty audience for something like this. So it was kind of just made sense.
I think so. I think it was really smart. You were right, totally right, that there's an audience kind of ripe for the picking. And it's nicely kind of set the way for, well, like Kyle's podcast, The Source of Uncertainty, for us. It's kind of opened up this space.
I've had a few people, I think mostly in jest, but ask me like, oh, like, how do you feel about these new modular podcasts? And I'm like, I listen to probably 30 different comedy podcasts. And if there was just one comedy podcast, I would be pretty bummed out because they all offer their different thing. So I'm so excited. And I think the more that start up, the more people will find the other ones, you know, maybe people found you through me and Kyle through you and, or whatever. And I think the more people, the better. I do want to say I'm getting a little rambly, I can tell, but because you guys are both from the UK, I have shared this on my show, but the original spark of the whole idea was from the Great British Baking Show.
The Great British Bake Off.
Yeah. So that planted the seed of the whole Podular Modcast. I dreamed up this idea of having a TV show that is what is now the Patch Challenge on Podular Modcast, random adjectives and nouns, and then they get 15 minutes to patch something up. And then I thought, oh, that'd be a great podcast. And I'd interview the person who did it. So
I was just going to say, it's interesting that potentially dreaming of Mary Berry is what's led to a Podular Podcast. Unless it was Paul Hollywood, which is maybe slightly more disturbing.
The whole cast, I forgot the comedic relief duo, but I just love Mel and Sue too. So yeah, it was me and Mel and Sue. My wife and I just kind of went on a whole binge of that show and just fell in love with it. So, and that kind of coincided with me getting into modular. Yeah. And then just one more thing about the beginning of it. People who've listened to the show know that I can get a little wooey. And one of my favorite podcasts is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. He's like a comedian, but he's also pretty into Buddhism, spirituality, and kind of weird stuff like that. And I kept kicking back and forth in my head, do I want to do this podcast? And I felt like a poser because I didn't know anything about it. I was like, well, that could be the conceit. And I was kind of back and forth and I decided I wasn't going to do it. And then a few weeks went by and I'm sitting on top of a ladder at my job that I hate listening to Duncan Trussell. And he's never said anything about modular synthesis before this. I'm kind of just dozing off from the conversation and staring into the void and thinking, maybe I should do that podcast. And right when that thought popped into my head, he just exclaimed, it's kind of like modular synthesis, man. And they weren't talking about modular. They were just talking about whatever. And it just like snapped me out of it. And then at that moment, I decided, I think I booked my first guest that day to start doing it. I was like, I have to do this now.
Yeah, that's serendipity for you, isn't it? A tap on the shoulder, you know. get going.
It's interesting mentioning that kind of imposter feeling sort of starting it when you just get into it. But I know I've said to you before, Tim, and possibly publicly in places, so people may have heard it, but I love that idea of someone sharing their journey from the start and kind of just kind of hands up saying, look, we're going to learn about this together. And it's a really lovely thing. I know in one of your shows you mentioned that you're really embarrassed that you didn't know what a surge system was. I think someone brought a surge yeah. up and you questioned what that was. To me, that doesn't, I'm not bringing that up almost to kind of embarrass you or anything. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make me think, oh God, Tim doesn't know what surge is. He shouldn't be doing this. It kind of makes me remember when I didn't know what surge was. Yeah. And it makes me think, oh God, he's in for a ride when he starts looking at this stuff. Yeah. Oh, Buchla, you know, someone mentions, oh, have you seen a music easel? I'm like, what's a music easel?
Yeah.
And I love that. It's kind of excitement for knowing someone's at that point on their journey, and everybody's journey through this is different, but I really like it and it works really well.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah,
I think that's you know, that's what I was sort of intimating to, this baptism by fire and just watching you mature over the sort of years. It's been great, but it's been lovely for you to say, like, okay, you know, I don't know where I'm going, I'm gonna do this, gonna do that, I'm learning as, you know, we go along, and just watching that journey. I think that's been part of the charm, as well as all the content that you've put out as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I kind of thought that would be a good conceit, because I figured a lot of people who would be looking for a podcast around the time that I started mine up, or really any time, are people who are just getting into it as well. So, and something, you know, that I think Ben has done for a lot of people in the community is kind of foster that, hey, you're new. Well, welcome to the club. We couldn't be happier to have you, which is so odd in kind of the artistic entertainment, or whatever you want to call it, realm. Every other music scene I've been in has been kind of snooty, and everybody kind of plays everything close to the vest. And I think something like modular, that it looks so intimidating because it is, but it's also, if you have the right people fostering your introduction to it, it's an easy hill to climb, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You certainly contributed towards that. And I think, again, this is one of the reasons I wanted to start this podcast up as well. I wanted to do a podcast for years. In fact, I was going to start one up on technology years ago, about 8 years ago, with a friend called Adam, called Tech Sorbet. You know, got everything all sorted out, but it never really kicked off. And I always fancied doing it. And then when I got into modular, probably like yourself, Tim, I'm just hungry for information, whether that's, yeah, you know, podcasts or videos.
I've been loving listening to your story on that, by the way. Sorry to cut in, but
no,
just to hear the evolution of how you kind of thought about what you wanted, what you thought you wanted out of it, and how you've kind of, seems like you've kind of come around in almost 180 of what you thought you were going to get out of it.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? And I think that's what's great about the modular journey, isn't it? It's just an absolutely sort of big journey of discovery, and it just pushes you along like a juggernaut behind you, doesn't it? If you've got to get stuff out, if you've got to do stuff, it really holds you to task.
Totally, yeah. I'm sure Ben knows this 10 times more than me, but there's something that when I get a piece of gear, it's cool to get the piece of gear, but there's a little bit of pressure that I put on myself, and I think it's an appropriate pressure to make sure that you do right by the device and the manufacturer, which is something that is, at the, you know, as a beginner, I'd say I'm mid novice level, that can get a little stressful. So I kind of like to tell everybody with my demos, they're pretty basic. You know, if you want some technical stuff, go check out Ben's YouTube. But I think that's useful for people who are also getting started. So
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to do that. I have to say, just the thought of getting a new piece and doing, you know, what you do, and then stepping it up to what Ben's doing as well. Yeah. I just think, oh gosh, that's, you know, some hard pressure, isn't it, to be able to do that?
But I think you get to know someone over time. So whatever level anyone thinks they're at personally, or others may judge them to be at, it's like a good writer in a magazine or something. You get to know that person and what they're into and how they're going to patch it. And over time, you start to get a feel for how much of the module am I hearing in terms of the kind of demo element, what flavor of is it giving me? But also, you know, why did Tim choose to make this ambient sound bed with it?
That's interesting.
Will the interface may lend itself to that? You know, I try to cover a lot with what I do, but sometimes a module is just screaming to be making or processing beats. And I don't think that's because I'm some kind of like techno warrior that's always wanting to make hard drum beats. Sometimes it's not that. And I think you get to know people and sort of think, oh, okay. And especially when, which is what we're going to lead on to shortly, you get to know someone's music as well and a bit of their personal style, which however objective any of us try and be, we can't help a little bit of personality getting in yeah. there.
Ed, a minute ago, you said, like, I couldn't do that. I have this theory that it's, I am just smart enough to know how dumb I am, but that's a recent discovery. And I think, I think when if you're pursuing any sort of thing where you're putting yourself out there and you're trying to, you know, whether it's music or a podcast or something, there's a part of you that has to, not blindly, but like you have confidence in it. And there's got to be a level of self-delusion, you know, because like yeah. the odds of making it big as a band or whatever are really, really small, but people still try it. And maybe if yeah. they fully knew what kind of upward battle it would be, they wouldn't try to do it. And I think I've got a lot of that. Like I started a little record label, but when I did that, I didn't save up any money for capital. I didn't have any, like, I had no idea what I was doing. I had a logo and some friends, and I was like, I just want to curate music. And now looking back on it, it's like, well, you probably would have done pretty good for yourself to, you know, save up a couple grand to where you could actually offer artists something to be on your label other than the logo that you think is really cool.
I'm just a great believer in whatever you have a passion about is just going out and doing it.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't be the artist I am now if I hadn't have had that mentality. And I'm very similar to you in the way that if I like something, if I want to do something, I just go in, but I go in big. And yeah. it is a bit of self-delusion as well, because if you sit back and analyze things and find out how hard they are, you wouldn't start anything. You really need to do that on the job and then just suffer the pain, go through it and come through the other end, mm-hmm. and then things will work out. But I'm a great believer in that, because if you don't move yourself into uncomfortable territory, you just don't grow, I don't think, as a person, and you just don't move forward. So I know what you mean with that. I know about self-delusion of it, but it's a good thing to have because you can work it out along the way.
Yeah, totally. And you just got to hope there's like a pinch of self-awareness along the way, because I've got music that I made in like pop rock bands that I would be mortified if anybody heard. But at the time, I thought it was God's gift to music. So, you know, like, yeah, it's a weird journey. I really hope that in 10 years, I don't look back on PodMod and be like, what the fuck was I doing?
You get to a point where I think things level off as being okay. I'm sure we're all embarrassed to some degree by older artistic endeavors, be them music or otherwise. But I think you reach a point where you're like, nah, maybe not what I do now, or stylistically I've changed, but
yeah,
it's not bad. You know, at least for me, there became a point, and I don't think it's in any kind of egotistical way, that after a certain point, I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't mind if people find that. Well, that's pretty good. It was all right. You know, it yeah, did what it did at the time.
It's funny that you say that, and I think this could be a good way to transition to talking into my music. I'm sorry to directing the show.
Hang on a sec. Aren't we supposed to do the segues in this show?
Oh, man.
God dang it, on your own show, Tim.
It was just a knee-jerk reaction. Well, what Ben said is true, because I feel like once I started making electronic music, I always felt like I had something I wanted to express, and I felt like I had something unique inside of me, but I never found that through, you know, writing indie or pop punk. I never felt like I was doing anything that was my own. And when I started getting into recording solo electronic music is when I was like, oh, this is that thing that I've been looking for since I was 12. And I do look back on the stuff that I, like, my first thing I released was like 5 or 6 years ago, and I still like 3/4 of it. So the upcoming release is the only full-length, actually, modular album. I've missed a few little things of just, like, 5-minute patches, but I don't really consider them real releases. But it was weird. I was looking for music to listen to. You know, you kind of get in a rut with whatever it is you're listening to, and you're kind of searching for stuff. And I feel like I started to get hints of it when I kind of started listening to, like, Daft Punk and Justice. But that was still a little too bouncy for me, or like polished. I still like that stuff, but I just kind of started getting led down this weird rabbit hole, and it was like Brian Eno ambient music and then like Flying Lotus Cosmogramma. Those two albums I kind of found at the same time, and they showed me that music could be whatever you wanted it to be. So right around the same time, I became friends with Greg Markle of Recovery Effects, and I was so into guitar pedals, and his stuff is just, he makes really, really nice, nasty, glitchy fuzz, just real harsh stuff that I was really digging. So I just got this idea of wanting to put drum machines through there. And so through getting into Greg's pedals and finding like cheap synths and drum machines, I just started kind of building loops, and I would just record for like 3 minutes, and whatever little chunk I really liked, I would end up cutting that up and kind of just pasting it. And I just kind of became like creating my own loops and then arranging them. And that kind of became my style of doing electronic stuff. That's kind of what was initially inviting about modular, because I saw the sounds that you can make in the control over making those sounds. I was like, well, if I'm doing this with guitar pedals and drum machines, imagine what I could do with that. The funny thing is I haven't taken that approach with modular. I haven't even tried it one time since I've gotten into it. So it's also kind of changed the whole way I approach making music. Yeah. And I'm still on that journey to find out, like, how do I want to make music from now on? Or I think that's always going to be changing. But I think doing the podcast definitely takes up enough of my time to where I don't have as much time to work on something like an album. So all of that together is kind of what birthed my upcoming album called Music to Come Down To, which is kind of a cheesy title, but my friends and I, I'm actually at my friend's house, so I'm talking about Steven Jett, who he plays classical piano lovely, and he made the album art for the upcoming album. But we like to go on what we'll call spirit quests, and you know, at the end of the night when things are slowing down, we like to lay down and listen to really nice, calm music. And I introduced him to, you know, Brian Eno ambient stuff. So I was kind of like, oh, I want to make something for us all to listen to in this scenario, because we all play music with and for each other. So I was like, this would be a fun practice, and it would be a way for me to try to make an ambient, a more ambient thing, because everything I've made up until now has been pretty harsh. And it would be a way for me to not have to try to make like my treatise on what I think music should be. So I'm proud of this album, but this is more of a kind of a relaxed approach. I just took a few months and made an ambient patch every night, and then just kind of saved the ones that I liked and put them together.
It's interesting that we get in these headspaces kind of creatively. I wanted to ask how the album came to be, and we'll come to a specific question about that in a second, but I do have a folder tentatively named Lullabies for Lorna, which is the name of my little girl, that I started making patches and music that felt like it was for both of us, but really it was only me listening. And it was just this kind of weird, blissed out headspace that you get into kind of just as a baby's born, and you're not sleeping and you're an emotional wreck and all this kind of thing. But that's where the track Natural Minor Signs came from, that ended up on the Din Tone Science release. I'm really proud of. And it sparked an idea, and it was very much, I mean, it was more solitary, because it was more for me. Then, as I say, Lorna wasn't listening. She wasn't, largely wasn't in the room for most of it. And my partner, Megan, wasn't listening. But you just find yourself in these headspaces. And I like that kind of casual approach. A lot of my modular music that's yet to see the light of day is like that. It's not necessarily, you know, the Div Kid album or whatever it is, as this kind of thing I'd want to push forward as my artistic message to the world. But it's a more relaxed approach to pieces that I find interesting, that have served a purpose for me or may serve a purpose for others. And the question I wanted to ask you, which you've answered, is that it feels like a collection of kind of repetitive patterns and sequences where the melodies and tones kind of develop over time. And it largely seems like it's all human interaction. You turning knobs, you fading things in. Patterns are repeating, and it's just kind of it just moves like a little moment in time. It feels like I'm getting a glimpse into your brain, whether that's Tim on a rainy Sunday afternoon or Tim on a Wednesday night after work. I thought that's what it was, weirdly. That's how it made me kind of feel the album was put together. And it's nice to know that kind of is the case.
I like that. That feels good to hear you say that you think about it that way, because I do feel that it is highly expressive of who I am. And I think the simple approach, another reason I did that, not just for time's sake, is if you listen to my older stuff, I mean, I was up to like 36 to 42 tracks, you know, and just like trying to mix and just kind of, you know, cut out the chaff and everything. It was just, it became, you know, I would work on one track for 30 to 60 hours and then never fully be totally satisfied. And I put so much pressure on myself to want, like, I just wanted people to just like it so much. And I think with this, I think I'm just gotten older and calmer with that kind of thing. And I'm just like, I'm going to make whatever this becomes. And if I like it, I'll release it. And that's just kind of how it happened.
Yeah, you just kind of have to let it go at some point. And I'm sitting on a lot of things I'm not letting go at this point for various reasons. We could get into psychoanalyzing me on that another time. But you say that you had a, you know, ton of tracks, Big DAW Productions. So technically, how was this all put together? Is it all the same? Is it different? Are you recording a stereo performance and then just a bit of processing? Is it multi-tracked? Is it layers and layers of separate takes on top of each other?
There's probably three moments on the whole album where I went in and added another layer. Everything else is just one performance of whatever that patch is. So it's 33 minutes and 33 seconds of little vignettes that just kind of fade in and out of each other. And each one of those vignettes was done as its own patch one night. And I'd do a couple, usually no more than three takes of, you know, how I wanted to perform it. And then I would unpatch it and that would be the end of that. So I had three mixers at the most, but a lot of the time, yeah, it's just a stereo, maybe six different inputs at the most at a time. I would say every single track on Music to Come Down To was made, patched and recorded in the same night, in the same session, really.
Thinking about mixing, this is mastered by Nathan Moody.
Yep, Obsidian Sound.
How big of a difference was that when you got it back?
It was huge. Mastering is that weird dark art, and I think you don't have to be an audiophile to hear the difference, but I think if you know how to mix your own stuff, you should definitely get it mastered because you will know notice the difference. And Nathan is just so skilled at doing this type of music. I wanted people to feel like they could lay in this album. You know, like if you lay in the middle of a room, I want you to feel surrounded by it. And I think without Nathan's mastering, I don't think that would have really been possible. Like it really does feel like a cloud to me now when I'm like listening to it on headphones.
Yeah. I mean, it's Nathan's ears as much as anything. I know people that maybe haven't had work mastered, well, by Nathan or other good engineers out there, that it's not about them being so heavy handed that it always comes back sounding very different. I noticed Nathan tweeted the other day that he's had a project in where he literally just needed a band of EQ and a little bit of limiting and that was it. It's having the ear to do the right thing. I know we're all guilty of this, myself definitely included in this, of almost having like preset chains and moves that you sometimes feel you have to make.
Oh yeah, totally.
Like, we're mastering, it might be a case of going, right, I need to touch a bit of EQ, I need to shave out the low end on the sides, it needs the top end widening, it needs limiting a bit. Not always. It's always about listening and having that ear. And I know Nathan's got such an ear for it.
I was just going through the album. There's a couple that really sort of stuck out to me, and probably two of the most stripped back and simplest, actually. And that was track six. It's just got this like looming pattern behind it. And I know that this is going to be a seamless mix, but you kindly give us the individual tracks to it as well so we could sort of look over that. And it's track six. So and we're just going to take a quick listen to it.
Choice is very effective.
Yeah, well,
thanks.
See, that I loved just the, you know, the solid sort of repetitive nature of it, and it really reminded me of sort of very early Human League Dignitive Labour type of repetitive pattern going on there, you know, very stripped back, sort of dark synths going on. How did you put that one together?
That one, I believe, is mostly rings and the telharmonic. Actually, most of this album is going to be a lot of telharmonic and rings. That one, it just reminds me of like a cowboy in space riding a weird space horse or something.
It's got a real prowling feel to it, hasn't it? A looming prowling feel.
Yeah, and so I wanted some of the stuff in the middle to get a little dark and kind of like, because the idea is to either listen to this while you're like meditating or just coming down from an exhilarating experience. I just want people to be able to chill out and listen to this, but I also kind of like the idea of locking into something and have it challenge you. So at the beginning, it sounds pretty pokey and kind of, it almost kind of sounds lackadaisical or goofy. But when I bring in the harmonies, it gets a little dark and I like to kind of bring those up and bring them back down. And
lackadaisical is a great word. The way it's got that kind of lackadaisical feel to it, but then the harmony choices are quite Aphex Twin like in terms of interval choices and tuning between the parts. And it does quite, in a dark way, kind of offset the feeling of the main pattern. Is that of any influence, Tim? That was just a general question I had. I mean, this piece is a good example of that, but is there any kind of early Aphex Twin influence in there?
If it is, it wasn't conscious, but I've definitely listened to selected ambient works too quite a bit. I kind of follow, I follow my ear more than plan what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So once I kind of get a basic idea of what it is, then I'll start making creative choices. But a lot of the time when I sit down to make something, basically the only rule for this whole project was it just kind of got to be the ambient side. But other than that, I didn't know what I'd make. So following that, yeah, I just kind of follow what sounds good. And I like Aphex Twin, so that makes sense. I'm not saying that I'm in the same caliber or anything.
No, but nor am I saying that you're trying to sound like Aphex Twin. There's just a hint of that feeling of those releases,
right,
with the kind of interval choices. You're just kind of like, oh, that's got that kind of early Aphex or Warp vibe of yesteryear.
Yeah, totally. And I think what Aphex Twin is so brilliant with is there's an art to making repetitive music engaging, and I find that it's pretty hard for me to do. And so that was another goal for this. Most of these things, they're kind of just the same thing happening, bringing different modulation sources in and messing with effects, but melodically I keep it the same. And that was kind of a challenge, is how long can I make this 16 or 8 step sequence engaging, you know, like not so much to like torture people, but like, you know, like, can I keep this thing that is very repetitive, can I make the sonic palette change enough to where you actually prefer the repetition?
Which brings me around to track 8, is another one I love. Let's have a quick listen to that. I love that one, Tim. It's got this hypnotic, relaxing, sort of repetitive tone to it. And just before you come on, I said to Ben, I've listened to this track 8 and it just reminds me of a start of a Beatles track. So I fished around and the start of The Sun King on Abbey Road. You've got this boom, 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 and it's just beautiful and relaxing. And I always think on that track, I could just listen to that all day. And you've come up with this beautiful sort of tonal, just these 2-3 melodic notes that come in on this sort of deep tone. What did you use to produce it?
Okay, I'll get into that, but I gotta say it's pretty funny that you mentioned Abbey Road, because I love the Beatles, but I don't really ever listen to them. But yesterday my wife and I decided to just put on Beatles records, and we listened to Abbey Road. We listened to side 2 of Abbey Road like 3 times yesterday. So that's funny that you brought that up.
Well, listen to The Sun King, track 10.
I'll have to check that out.
And obviously they're not similar in a vast way, but they give me that beautiful relaxation sort of feel, both those and that, in the same sort of way, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, you totally. And I'm really glad that you felt that from it, because that was the intention. It's towards the end of the album, and this is when I want people to almost be falling asleep to it, you know, and kind of being lulled into it. So that's one of the reasons it's really long. Well, it was the first track that I made in the sessions, and I kind of used it as my reference track. Okay, this is what I want. This is what I want this album to be like. It was basically just the telharmonic and the Spectral Multiband Resonator from 4MS. And when those kind of like paddy chords changed, that was just me manually turning the dial to different like chord positions. So that was cool. There was no like CV control in the changing. So if you listen closely, like some of it's a little off time. And I kind of liked that. It's kind of like
yeah,
a weird.
I like that.
The only problem I had a hell of a time EQing that because for some reason, the way I recorded that, and like I said, I unpatched everything when I was done. So when I went to go mix it, I noticed like the mids were like almost unbearable if I turned it up loud enough for you to hear that melody. But I just loved that melody so much with that gong. Ben, you mentioned Bit Crusher. This was the only effect outside of the rack I used. I used just like kind of a stock Cubase guitar amplifier with some fuzz. And I just doubled the whole track and ran it through that fuzz and just kind of buried it in the mix and put some reverb on it. So, and then just scooped the bad mids that I didn't like. And so I was able to retain that mid frequency with that melody I liked by running it through the right distortions and burying it in the right way.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to be heavy handed with that stuff.
Yeah.
I remember one of the first kind of pro mastering sessions that someone did with a band I was in, and it wasn't necessarily that we'd done such a bad job, but they took a huge scoop out of the lower mids and it just cleaned everything right up. Mm-hmm. And we were really worried that like none of us had the ear or the equipment to make anything half decent. And it's quite a regular thing, apparently. It's like the trick that Devox have told me where, and it's a really good one for anyone to try, you take a little dip out of the upper bass region to make the bass feel louder because it creates some separation. If you put a little dip at between kind of 100-200 hertz, it makes everything below that, it kind of almost gives it space to breathe, the kind of connection between the mids and the bass. Mm-hmm. Not a huge gap, just a couple of dB or so, but the perception shift for us listening to that, it's like you say, kind of really bricking something into mm-hmm. a ton of distortion, but then heavy-handedly EQing it and sitting it under.
Yeah.
You've just been willing to do that and getting to a point where you realize, either through experimentation or experience, that it's just sometimes what some things need.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to really bash it with a hammer until it fits.
It's funny you mentioned that. I do that almost knee-jerk reaction to every single thing. That's the first thing I do. I slap the EQ on and I do that duck right in that 100, 200, just a couple dB. Like before even listening to it, I just know that everything needs, like that may be something I shouldn't do every time, but it becomes just such a habit because you're right. You get such a separation. But I just, yeah, like I said, I love that little chord change melody so much that I wasn't willing to let it go. So yeah, I just kind of ham-fisted it into, and that's another, going back to Nathan Moody, he really made that one work. That was one I was kind of worried maybe not being able to make it on just because of the frequency. To some of it was a little too much, and he did a really good job cleaning that one up.
Talking about the melodic patterns, how much were planned? How much was composed? Did you use any random on there, any sort of CV sources and experimentations? And although it's modular based, I get the feeling throughout the whole of the album that you've got your hands on it, you've got your paws on it. Everything isn't being run by CV, that you are there manipulating it. Is that right or wrong?
Well, yes and no. It's correct in everything but melody. So I heavily performed everything and there was a lot of hands-on and not a whole lot of CV in the changes of like where effects would be and the wet dry of effects or wave shape, yeah, filtering, that kind of stuff. But every single sequence, except for the song we just talked about, because I did hand play that on the actual SMR, every right. single sequence was from Turing machine through a quantizer. I would let it play until I found the sequence that I really liked, and I would lock it in, and then I would just record that.
Nice.
It's amazing how musical that thing is for a random generator.
So yeah.
It's almost like it has good and bad days for me, and obviously it's me that's having a good or a bad day. The circuit doesn't have a differing mood depending on outside mm-hmm. influence. Yeah, it's really on it. Sometimes.
Yeah, well, so what I love about it is when it does spit, you know, I'd sit there and just listen for sometimes, you know, I just like, as I was building the patch and finding, you know, the effects I want, once I had like kind of the voice I wanted, as I was building it, I would just let it go. And then once I kind of heard something that I really liked, I would lock it in and then listen to it for a few minutes. And, you know, I was like, oh, I'll try again. That's not the one. That was only on a few of the songs. And then on some of the other songs, I just left it on random and I didn't lock anything in. And I wanted to do that on purpose by A, using the same sequencer to do the whole thing. So it kind of had the same personality. And I also wanted it to have that repetitive thing we were talking about earlier, but also I want at times for it to sound super disjointed to where you can't lock onto a melodic pattern so much. It kind of fools you into thinking you can because it's in the same sequence and because it's random or whatever.
Yeah, just the way the thing works kind of fools you, kind of fools our ear a lot of the time, I think. You mentioned, you know, setting up effects. I wanted to ask if there were any key effects for the whole release, any key, and as well, not just for effects, but any key modules, either as a deliberate attempt to create consistency or just something that you were naturally kept gravitating towards.
Definitely. Telharmonic, rings, angle grinder from Schlappy Engineering. That's kind of the main voice thing. I used the Algorithm L1, I believe it's the stereo reverb on the Disting. I used that heavily and did a lot of CV control over the wet dry to give kind of a weird, almost tremolo sidechain compression hybrid sound to it with just the wet dry on a reverb. So that's in there a lot. The DLD from 4MS is in there quite a bit.
In that track 8, there's like a tape hiss in the background. What's that produced by?
I think that's the high end of that guitar amp plugin that I used.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And in order to retain that melody, I had to really, because that melody almost only existed in this really small but unpleasant band of mids. So yeah. In order for it to come out, that's why I use that like weird distortion, not weird, but kind of just a stock amplifier distortion. Right. And in order to keep that hiss was part of it, but I ended up kind of liking it.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it just sounds like a tape hiss in the background, doesn't it? You know, it's warm, it's not nasty at all, and it's sort of a nice sort of warm glue as it goes along.
Yeah.
Just thinking track by track, the first track, Prime Materia, it works really nicely as an intro in that it builds up both the modulated noise and kind of, you know, the almost sample and hold like modulation kind of leans itself back to the origins of modular in a very kind of familiar vintageness to it. You know, it's got that kind of 50s sci-fi almost vibe to that sample and hold modulation. But the way that the melody enters just feels very much like an intro for an album. It seems to work really well. Was that intentional? Did you maybe produce it at the end so that it would fit the start, or did it just happen to be one of the pieces?
That's spot on. I did that one last. That was the last one I did, and I actually had finished the record and sent it over to Nathan for mastering, and then I was like, hey, I'm gonna take a few tracks out and add a few. So that one, and there's another track that sounds very similar to it, are actually the same patch, just kind of rearranged in a little way. And both of those were made on a very, very snowy day, which is rare in Seattle, where my wife and I were snowed in the house, and that's what it looked like outside, that first track. And I did want it to be kind of this swirly, you're entering this thing, you know, like it's purposely, yeah, different than everything else, I think.
We mentioned this before we went on air, and we were asking you, you know, how did you get the names of your tracks? Can you run us through that one?
Well, yeah, it's kind of embarrassing, but I think it's kind of funny at the same time.
I think it's a great story.
Yeah. We kind of mentioned that I wanted it to be one piece and just call it Music to Come Down To, but I also know if I was receiving this album, I would want to be able to skip between tracks. And if you can do that, you need track names. And I was about to send the masters over to the label, Flag Day Recordings, and I didn't have names. And I've been kind of on a Carl Jung kick lately, so I just looked up Carl Jung terms and picked out the ones that I thought sounded cool and had a cool definition. I feel like they were picked with a little bit of purpose. I think I didn't randomly assign them.
Yeah.
And I kind of put them in an order to where you could almost build a story arc out of it, like Prima Materia. That's like that which everything was made from. So that's kind of why I called that first swirly one that. But I also don't want to get too heady with it. It was just like, oh shit, I need track names and I'm really bad at this. So.
You mentioned wanting this to be one continual mix. Is that one of the reasons to release it on cassette?
Definitely. I've always been a fan of cassette because I like having a tangible artifact to hold on to. And it's just way more affordable to do cassettes. I think people buy cassettes more lately. But yeah, that was definitely part of it. I think with the digital thing, what I like to do is make track one the continuous mix, and then 11 tracks after that, you could go and hand select them. So it's not just for the cassette, but the last song of side A is the first song of side B. And so the first song of side A is the last song of side B. So it's just goes around in a circle.
That's a nice way to do it. One of the general things I wanted to ask was that it's overall got quite a rich analog texture. And we now know that rings and telharmonic are a large part of this, and also the slappy engineering module as well. But I know you're a fan of digital generally, and we know rings and telharmonic are digital. Do you put the tone of the album down to anything in particular? Is there like analog filters you like to run this stuff through, or bits of distortion, however soft that may be? It doesn't sound cold in the way that rings and the telharmonic can. And I don't mean that as a judgment of rings and telharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
Cold has just as much of a valid place in sound as warm does.
Right.
It's just we often get lyrical about, oh, it's this lovely warm analog thing. But you seem to stride both elements quite well. But knowing it's made with those potentially colder type modules, I just wonder if there's anything going on to kind of warm it up, if you like.
To be honest, I don't use a lot of filters, and I didn't use a lot of distortion on this, but I think what you're getting is there's a noise output on the telharmonic, which I definitely would kind of bury in the mix with some heavy reverb. And then I would almost always run a noise source into the resonator in rings.
Okay.
Yeah. So I used noise with a lot of reverb and delay, and that's probably where you're getting kind of that distortion feel. And then the telharmonic has some pretty cool, I don't even know what to call the parameters on them, but they have filter like.
Yeah. The way it kind of carves harmonics.
Yeah.
In and out. It's just going at it with a different kind of technology. Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting. We mentioned on our James Bond episode, which was 007, of course, with
Heimbach Bond.
I love the title of that, by the way. Was it from Heimbach with Love? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
We talk about that, even like the hiss of tape, even when it's harsher and in your face, there's some weird kind of warm blanket element to noise. Not, you know, just white noise straight out of the speakers, but there's just, I think it's the way that we tune it out. We're very good as kind of as humans, as it were, for tuning noise out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that when it's there, it just has this warming quality. So it's quite a clever trick to bury it underneath other things.
I think it really can add some just more character to it. Like, cause like you said, like, and it's not a dig at these, but some of the more digital stuff can sound cold. I pretty much have a 50-50 split of digital and analog, but yeah, it's funny. I actually don't even have a rings anymore. After I made this record, I was like, well, I did that. I just didn't feel like I needed it anymore.
So Tim, I suppose the litmus test of this album, because originally you said it was sparked off by you and your friends coming home of a night and just wanting to chill out and to listen to something very ambient. Have you done that with everybody? Have you sat down and done that with your album? And how did that turn out? Was it a thumbs up?
Yes, we did. And it was a lot of fun. We ended up doing both One Way and Back, you know, the both sides, the continuous mix.
Yeah.
And it was funny because my friend Steven, whose house we usually do this, if you go on my Instagram, you'll see every once in a while I'll post pictures of a guy playing a baby grand piano with my modular set up under it. And
yeah,
so that's where we usually do it. I'm actually there. I'm here right now in his basement. They're upstairs hanging out. But yeah, we did that a few weeks ago and Steven waited months. I think I had the master for 2 months and he didn't listen to it until we could all align and we all got together. So yeah, he listened to it for the first time with us and it was cool because he ended up doing the album art for it. So
I have a question that rings back around to the Podular Modcast. And has any of the PodMod patch challenges influenced any of these pieces or generally influenced your patching, which therefore will have influenced these pieces?
Again, like probably with the Aphex question being an influence, I can't imagine it hasn't. I can't think of anything specifically. It's kind of like the same question of what have you learned since doing this? It's kind of too much, but I would say just listening to how people talk about how they approach doing the patch challenge and then listening to the patch challenge is almost certainly influenced how I patch. I just don't understand how it couldn't. And I sometimes end up cutting that, but like I do edit some parts of the show. And sometimes when we talk about what they did on the patch, it can get kind of lengthy. So it is a cool way to kind of get a sneak peek into another artist's brain on how they think about approaching things. And I think having the adjective and noun approach, it kind of seems arbitrary, but I feel like it's kind of revealing as well.
It's a really, having done it, it's a really interesting process.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. I can't believe I waited like 30 episodes to do it myself, but...
I like how you just got all these people to do it, and then you probably did it and went, that's really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I did it on the first episode and then just kind of didn't do it again and forgot, and then I ended up doing another one, and I was like, oh, man.
It's like being back at school with exams where the majority of the marks come from your working out as opposed to the actual answer at the end. You kind of just have to give up the fact that this maybe musically isn't going to be the thing that you wanted to do. It's more that the interesting bit to me is the journey towards it.
I think that's 100% true. And I try to tell people that, especially if they kind of express that they're a little nervous about it. Because some people are a little like, I don't know if I want to do this. And I'm like, trust me, like everybody, it turns out just fine. And it's really more about the process because everybody knows that you've had 15 minutes to do it. If anybody judges you off of that, well, then they can kick rocks.
Well, like, 15 minutes in modular time is just ridiculous, isn't it?
So it's a short amount of time, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to really take into consideration that. And I'm guessing everyone who's listening is into modular. They know how challenging that's going to be.
Half of that is me just crawling under my desk to turn on. Yeah.
And just sort of sweeping all the boxes of modular out of the way. Just to get to it would take you about 15 minutes, wouldn't it?
I have to say I've been blown away with what people can do in the 15 minutes. Yeah. I haven't heard a bad one yet, and I'm not just saying that, you know. I've heard some that have just completely like, you made this in 15 minutes, like been totally blown away. So yeah, and it's funny, some people were like, yeah, I was done after 4 minutes, and then some people were like, oh my god, I could have used another 30 minutes. So it's been really insightful to see like just the different ways people approach how do they patch and everything.
Well, fantastic. I think that sort of about wraps it all up. It's nice to talk about the end of your podcast when it's coming to the end of ours. Tim, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Absolutely. Thank you guys both so much. Yeah, this has been so much fun, like I said, to be on the other end of it. And Ed, I want to get you on PodMod. I got to get you in the hot seat for a patch challenge.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to that one. Yeah, I definitely am going to be nervous on that one. But yeah, I'd love to come on, Tim, and have a chat. I'll probably do better at the chatting than the patching, but I'll give it a go.
No, I look forward to that too. I know we've all kind of said similar things, but selfishly doing this and listening to everyone else's shows, it's just a way for me to engage and listen to everyone else that bit more. So I'm looking forward to you doing a patch challenge too, Ed.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, that's for sure, definitely. Yeah, so I'd like to sort of round it up and just say thank you to all those people that have kindly rated and reviewed us on iTunes. If you do find yourself over there, please give us a shout out, a thumbs up and a quick review. If you'd like to listen to our podcast with detailed show notes, head over to our website, www.esotericmodulation.com. We also have a monthly newsletter that you can sign for over there too.
Also check us out on Instagram, which is fast becoming my kind of favourite place to share stuff. So that's a good place to get hold of us, and Facebook, both at Esoteric Modulation.
Tim, Ben, really enjoyed that one. It's been a lot of fun.
Hell yeah, that was so much fun.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Cheers, Tim. Bye.
Bye.